Welcome to Season 7 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Daniel Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
Hey Game Design Unboxed listeners, climb higher than ever before with Mountain Goats Legacy, plus dive into Enchanted Ivy, Allplay's new solo-only debut on Kickstarter. Many of you may not know this, but Mountain Goats was one of the first games I played from Allplay, as well as one of my favorites, and now they've gone and made a Legacy version. In this new Legacy game, each turn, you're going to roll and combine dice to race up the mountain, get to the top to score, but don't get knocked off. If you roll the goat symbol, activate new abilities, powers that rotate every mission. As your story progresses, you'll unlock even more powerful abilities and face tougher challenges. The mountain itself may even transform beneath your feet. Hit the follow button to get notified on the launch. You'll be able to back Mountain Goats Legacy on January 13th. Rumor has it that a special deluxe edition will also be available, so check it out. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 133, Honeybuzz. Today we're joined by Paul Solomon, game designer and creative director of Gamehead, and I'm super excited. You are officially the first recording of the seventh season, so thank you for being on.
Woohoo! Thank you very much for having me. Congratulations on, what did you say, 130 episodes?
Yeah, this is 133, so going strong.
That's very many.
Yeah, started in 2020.
All right, season seven. Not a lot of shows make it to a good season seven, so I'm excited here.
I know. I was like, hopefully it doesn't fall off. I feel like sometimes when you get towards that like 10 season, but I think we're starting strong. Honeybuzz is actually one of my favorite games that continues to stay in my apartment as I try to bring my number down because I have like 300 games, but I very much enjoyed it. And I actually got to show it off at Essenspiel, the very first one I ever went to. So it has a special place in my heart. So I'm very excited to have you kicking off.
Super cool. And thanks for showing it off. I've never been to Essen, but like having games there is like a really exciting thing. And Honeybuzz was like, it wasn't my first design, but it was my first good design. And I had other games come out before that, but this is still like the one that has a special place in my heart. So for you to be doing it out there is awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. And for anyone who doesn't know you, mind talking a little more about how you got into designing games and maybe also touch on Gamehead?
Sure. I actually am a teacher. I've been a math teacher for almost 20 years, and I still teach math two classes a day, basically, seventh grade and seniors. And I've always just been a maker and a doer. Like I was a juggler. I still juggle, which is really creative. And I wrote music for a long time. And once I started getting into playing games, it's just sort of a natural thing for me to want to try to make games. And I started with this attempt at a deck building version of the video game FTL, Faster Than Light, which was horrible, as you would expect. Eventually found some cool ideas we'll talk about here to start Honeybuzz. And from there, I went to the St. Louis Board Game Designer Meetup and met a lot of people there that then they introduced me to, oh, you should meet my friend John Covew. He runs Genius Games. John was like, you should meet my friend Jamie, who runs Stonemaier Games. So that's where I ended up pitching. And I was playtesting for people. At one point, I was the head of development at Elf Creek Games, who published Honeybuzz and Santa's Workshop, which I worked on and love. And then for the last year and a little bit, I've been the creative director at Gamehead, which is the game publishing arm of what used to be Gamer Mats. They print custom play mats in the US. Now we make games. So I'm basically the guy in charge of all of what we do to make games. We put out six small box games last year that rock, including Trinket Trove from Sandara Tang. Well, she did the art. We got a lot of good ones coming up. We'll talk about them maybe later. But that's been really, really, really satisfying to sort of like, again, I do teach two classes a day, but then also I'm like full-time at Gamehead making games.
Yeah, no, I'm sure the math background's got to help you with balancing games.
100%.
I always joke that I am not as much the math brain, where it's wild thinking like I was 3 years ahead in math in Arizona, but in my mind, Arizona's like behind on math. So like, sure. I'm probably average person math, but I feel like I use more like in my gut, like this is probably right. And then design a lot more off feel versus someone else who maybe you design a little more off math. I'm not really sure.
Yeah. And there's like, so I made mathematical art for a number of years. And in mathematical art, like visual art, you could find some on my website. There's a mix between what the math tells you it should look like or what tells you is a structure that could appear, you know, reasonably, that has some like truth or properness to it. But then there's also this blend of like, but what do I want it to look like? You know, it's not just you just take a piece of math and put it on a page and now you like it. There's this blend of justifiable, well-reasoned math with the aesthetic. And so in game design, like that's very, very much the thing of I can analyze a game's mathematics and say, this is how the point structure should be to make it balanced or make it fair or make the different modules of the game like equally reasonable for gameplay. But then if players play it and then are telling me that their aesthetic experience is totally off of that, they're just as right as what I was saying. And this has happened in, I can't remember now exactly what the game is, but I think it was maybe Honey Buzz, where players were saying like, these point values are wrong and this is way too swingy. And even though I have like rock solid explanations as to why they're wrong in some objective sense, it also doesn't matter. You know, and playtesters' feedback is just as valid in some sense.
Oh, totally. I had this with Her Story when Nick Bentley and I were co-designing. And constantly, since my background is graphic design and psychology, I look at more how people perceive the numbers and perceive the fairness. And so I will break his math where he's like, but it's mathematically balanced. And I'm like, yes, but it's an engine building game. And if it comes out at this point, it's going to be perceived as like better or worse or whatever. And so we'd have these very interesting conversations on what would make the game better. And I think it's good to have multiple types of brains when you're working on projects.
Yeah. And my my buddy, Pete Wissinger, who's co-host of the Decision Space podcast, he and I live in St. Louis, and he just designed Origin Story with Jamie Stegmaier. He and I talk about games the most of anybody I talk about games with. And we have very, very different perspectives about game design and game development. And the things that I say about numbers could not matter less to him. And sometimes I'm like, but do you even get what I'm saying? The way that he makes his cases are very much this intuitive thing. And I struggle to sometimes find the value there. But they are both valuable. And so the butting heads is actually pretty important for us to like move forward in design.
Yeah, totally. When you're working together, or even I guess in your conversations, do you find that it's hard for you to resolve it and be like, oh, I see your side? What gets you there?
No, it's definitely very hard for me in a way that I wish it was not. I wish that this was easier for me. And maybe there's some like neurodivergence there, but like I so rely on reasoning and explanations for like, this is why you should believe this thing I'm saying. And it's like, well, why? And here are the reasons I can explain it to you. I worked with a designer on a game and we had this big, big question about the player count balance. How's the game going to feel the same at 2 versus 5 players? Or on the other hand, do we care if it feels the same? What are the differences and is that okay? I came up with a scheme to shift it and make it feel similar. You know, there were problems with like the economy of something and how many points you're getting. So I had a scheme, and then he had a different scheme, which basically was to upend all of the underlying point balance so that resources totally change their values. And so you can imagine how like totally changing the underlying point structure would like shake me up. And I'd have to go like, okay, what's the effect of that? And why should we do that instead of something else? And all he would say to me was just, I think the move is to do this. I really think that's the move. And I just can't move forward with that. You know what I mean? I think there are ways where Pete and I will sort of butt heads and understand this about each other and then just like be like, okay, we'll just sit with that for a little bit. You know, we'll just back away from it and come back. And later I'll feel like maybe that's reasonable. Or maybe I'll find my own explanation of it that's sort of different from the way that he's maybe thinking of it so that we can arrive at some agreement together. Just to give a concrete example, we co-developed No Loose Ends, which is a Taiki Shinzawa trick-taking game, and then also Trick to the Future, which is a really crazy trick-taking game, from Taiki Shinzawa. We were really hung up on the nil bidding. Like, how should you get points if you don't win any tricks? We get to the point where like it's almost like we're fighting more than arguing, me and Pete. But at the end of it, it's like we had an answer that we both felt made a ton of sense. So somehow you get there. And our friendship is intact. And so that's really good.
No, that's great to hear. I feel like for me, I've gotten a lot better at explaining why I feel a way, and I can explain it, but I could see where that would be hard if it's just like, I think we should do this without an actual explanation.
Yeah.
I will at least figure out how to articulate my thoughts when I'm presenting something. And I always feel bad when someone gives an idea and I turn it down. But if I do turn it down, I give the reasons why I don't think it'll work. And I'm always open to still testing it And I feel kind of good when it breaks or does the thing I said it would.
Yeah. And that's, for me also, that is kind of like the end of the line is, I was working with Bruno Faiduti on a game recently, and he and I felt very differently about this one thing. And I just said, you know, look, I really value you as the designer of this thing, and I will promise you that I will put it in front of more testers, and we'll see if they say the thing that we're worried they'll say. That is the bottom line, is when we say, here's what the rule should be, the first question, the first reason is like, well, what will the effect on gameplay be? What will the effect on gamer experience be? And we can theorize it, but then if we can't agree on the theory, we can just do it in practice and just put it on tables and see what people say.
And I like that most of the games I work on are pretty streamlined and typically play in that 30 or less minutes. So you can do a quick A/B test and compare what you're theorizing very quickly and prove your point, or don't. Maybe you find out you're wrong, but I think people need to just like put their ideas out on the table more often and get it out of their head.
Yes. Yes.
Well, no, I love that you're doing a lot of different work on different sides, but for Honeybuzz, we said that this is the one that's near and dear to your heart and why we're focusing on it. I mean, it's also my favorite of the games you put out, but for anyone who hasn't played mine, given a little synopsis of how to play.
Sure. So thematically, the bees of Sweetwater Grove have discovered economics, and they realized that if they can just sell their honey to the bears and the woodland creatures, then they won't destroy their hive. And so that is the key to their peace and future prosperity. So in the game, you serve as Her Majesty's accountants. You are these little bees that are in charge of one section of the hive, and you grow the hive, expand it. You go and collect nectar to then turn to honey to sell and fulfill orders and so on and get points. That's sort of the theme. But mechanically, the game is a tile-laying worker placement game with some twists. All of the tiles are double hexagon tiles. Basically, as we get into the design, I'll describe them more carefully. But so imagine two hexagons, and then they have some colors on them, like the ends are white and the middles are brownish. And you connect these tiles together. And when you connect the tiles together, it creates holes that are hexagons. And the holes that are hexagons are where these hexagon nectar tiles will go. And so you're building this hive out to create spaces for nectar and put the nectar in. And then you sort of fan that to turn it to honey, and then there's a little market mechanism. But the couple twists on the worker placement side, you know, typically you would worker place, you put a worker out and take an action, and that doesn't happen in Honeybuzz. There are six types of tiles, and they're action tiles. So when you place workers, you get an action tile, but you may not get that action right away. The tile goes into your hive, your player board, and if you create one of these empty spaces, if you create one of these holes where nectar will go, then all the surrounding action symbols trigger. So each of the types of tiles has a different symbol, and then depending on how you place it, you might activate that action, including other actions. And then if you build another cell, another empty space that's next to a tile you already had, you'll get that action again. So unlike most worker placement games where you look up at the worker placement board and go, okay, which action do I take? In Honeybuzz, you actually look down at your player board and say, okay, which space do I want to finish? Because that'll get me actions. And most of the actions I'm going to do are already on my board. So then I look up at the worker placement board and I say, okay, which tile do I want to supplement? Which tile do I want to add into that? And then there's some other worker costing up there. Like if you've put a worker in the forage space, then I have to put two workers in the forage space. Sort of like a Manhattan Project where there's a ramping worker cost. So the worker placement economy, action economy is a little different. That's the main gist of Honeybuzz. It's worth mentioning that a huge, huge piece of the game's success is Anne Heidsieck's incredible art. I, especially now that I'm a creative director, game developer, I completely understand art sells games a 10,000%. It's the only thing that can get someone to pick it up off the shelf is art, but then gameplay will keep it on shelves.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree with that. And I know for me, something I loved about creating that hole that you'd put in the nectar and then turn it into honey and all the like selling and stuff, I like thinking about what actions I wanted to do in what order and making sure to put those together in their own kind of like circle that you're creating. That was really interesting for me because I love in kind of worker place mini games when you do have to time out your actions correctly. And it's like, if you mess up those, so say you have certain things you need, but you don't have the action in order to take it before someone else does, it's so much a timing problem. And I used to be a cook for a while there. And I always found the best part about cooking was trying to time out things so everything's done at the same time. That was something I really loved about the game.
First off, about cooking, you're so right that like that puzzle of I need to get everything to finish at the same time is so inherent in cooking. And cooking is one of the places where I feel the most anxiety for this reason. It's like a real-time dexterity game with high stakes for me. You know what I mean? Because the food has to be good or people are going to be mad at me. But in Honey Buzz, yeah, it very much has this sequencing. And when you resolve one of your little action rings, you get to choose the order you do them in, which is really useful. But you can do things like, okay, I'm going to forage to grab this, you know, clover honey to put it in here so that then when I fan and produce honey, I'll have a little triangle of nectar spaces and I can produce on all three of them. Oh, but let me first sell this one so that I can reproduce on that space. So you get a lot of little like order of operations, sequencing puzzles on each little turn. There's also some tempo pieces to the game, and this stuff is built on much more even in the expansion. There are some contests for the game, like public objectives for the game. Usually one is end game for something you've done in your hive, like have the most empty cells or have the same type of nectar or whatever. And then there's one that's usually a race, which is like the first person to get three of one type of nectar. And so in your action, sort of like early tempo stuff, you are trying to push for that. And so that means that not only do you need to sequence the actions you take on a turn, but you might want to front load your game with a certain type of action. And maybe you want to forage early. So you put like multiple forage action tiles next to each other. That's going to maybe let you do this quickly, but it's also going to have an impact on like the later part of your game, because you're going to have to go back and re-trigger those action tiles by placing next to them. And maybe later you won't want to forage as much. So, and it's very interactive in that way, that I have to pay attention to what you're doing to figure out if that's what I want to be doing. The game in many ways is a race. The end game trigger is just based on like the market. So I guess I should say, when you go to the market, there's price tracks for each type of honey. There's four types of honey. And when you buy a honey or when you sell a honey, you get points and then the price drops. And sort of thematically, these bees have discovered economics, but they're not very good at it. They just keep flooding the market with product. And so the prices are dropping. It is a bear market. So these prices are dropping, and once they hit the bottom, the game ends. And so you're incentivized naturally to sell as fast as you can to get those points. But if I'm the only person that has acacia honey, and I can feel comfortable knowing that other people are not going to sell acacia honey, the price will not drop. And so I can sort of delay selling and try to get a big stockpile of acacia so that I can sell them all at once and get 8 points for all of them, and then it'll just drop one step. So there's, you know, It's interactive in these subtle, like, indirect ways that some people appreciate, or if they don't, they still get to play a fun little, like, spatial puzzle on their own board that is enjoyable.
Oh my god, yes. And I'm a huge fan of spatial puzzles, so I am quite happy role-playing. But what inspired this design?
There's a lot of little, like, pieces. This was pretty early in my game-playing life, really. Like, I mean, modern hobby game-playing. So there's lots of games that show up in pieces of it, like the way that you complete a cell and then get actions from that, which is the core of the game now, was not necessarily the core at the start. And like that came from the great feelings in Castles of Mad King Ludwig, where it's like, I complete a little room, so now I get a bonus action, that kind of stuff. But the first start was, you know, I'm a math teacher. I have a master's in mathematics, and I was a mathematical artist for a while. So I know a ton about tile laying, like tessellations and different types of tiles and patterns and stuff. And this is one of my favorite styles of games, is tile laying games. My friends will know that I make them play like 100 Phil Walker Harding tile placement games over and over. I have a shelf over there. It's just a 2x4 of only Phil Walker Harding games, 2x4 Calyx of only Phil Walker Harding games. So I wanted to find a tiling system that had not been used to see if I could like leverage the math that I know to make something new. So the one that I came up with was a rhombus shape, which obviously if you look at Honey Buzz, it's not rhombuses, it's hexagons. So if you take two equilateral triangles and stick them next to each other, you get this rhombus with 60 and 120 degree angles. The nice thing about this tile is that it can cover your whole backsplash, your whole bathroom wall, but it can do it in different ways. you can have them all kind of point in the same direction, like up and down diamonds. Maybe you can imagine that almost like Argyle shape that it would make up and down the wall. Or you can sort of like put three of them together to make a hexagon, and then like with their sort of wide angles touching, and then just use those hexagons to cover the plane. That's a pretty standard one. You'll get some places where three of the tiles touch, and some places where six of the tiles touch, and it'll look like this little flower. And there's others. There's several others. Like you can do one that is sort of like chevrons. It's like double Vs poking into each other. And then what else am I missing? Other ones. There's one that you basically can have five tiles that point at a certain location. So, and you can mix and match these. Like you can have it start one way and then switch to it being a different way. As you lay down those rhombus tiles, you have like a huge amount of freedom in how you want it to look. Like you could have a little corner where three of them touch, or four or five, or four in a different way. So my original idea was, those are the tiles. When you make a corner, the amount of tiles that are in that corner determine what type of thing goes in that corner. So like maybe it determines what type of building you're able to put there, or what type of, ultimately it was like what type of resource you're able to produce there. So in Honeybuzz, if you have one of these empty spaces that's made with three tiles, it is clover, which is like the cheapest, most common type of honey. But if you have one that has five that poke in there, it takes you longer to build, and it gives you an acacia honey, which is more points. So that was the first start. And then why it looks like they are hexagons is because, since I knew I was going to be making these places where I would like add a tile, like put a building on top or something, I figured, well, let me just cut away the stuff that it would sit on, and then it can sort of sit down on the table on the same level, right? So this is called truncation in mathematics. You just sort of like cut off the ends of those tiles, and in the middle, you sort of cut this little V in. And so it's a rhombus, but it's cut in a way so that it looks like two hexagons. And then the spaces that they make when they connect are more hexagons. So that was the very first thing for Honeybuzz.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it made so much sense seeing how they're combined, but I would not have thought to do it, even though I also love tile placement and I'm a huge fan of like hexagon games where you're just adding things.
Yeah, we actually on the Decision Space podcast, I think we did two episodes just on like tiles and how like what the impact on a decision space is for using square tiles versus hexagon tiles. Like when you put that in your game, how does that shift it? And there's so many considerations about like, what if the tiles are representing paths? You know, there's a million things. And what using these rhombus tiles did was it gave you this placement puzzle of like, the rotation really matters in a different way, not just because it changes. You know, if I rotate a square in Carcassonne, it changes which terrain is on which side, but it's still going to fit into a square grid. And when I do it in Honeybuzz, it like changes the landscape of the future of the grid's possibilities. So that's really interesting, just on its own. There's actually one type of shape that is not used in Honeybuzz, which people sometimes realize, which is if you put six tiles all pointing at the same space, you can get this fifth type of shape, but it's just not used. So I think somewhere on Board Game Geek, I tell people, you know, if you make that, just you can put whatever type of nectar you want in there. I don't think we've said this, but when you have three of these tiles connected, the coloring shows you that the space you've created is like all brown because it used all the middles of the tiles. So that's that certain type. And then this was a big breakthrough, was how to communicate to players the like core idea of the shape you make with the tiles determines the resource type. Because originally I was thinking about not just the cell itself, not just the empty space, but the surrounding tiles. So I was thinking about a clover is made out of three things, so you have to imagine this ring of three tiles. But it's really hard for players to visualize the whole surrounding structure, especially when it's inside of this big tableau you're building. So by coloring the edges, coloring these final edges, like the ends of the long ones are white and the others are brown, so that you can visually see like how much it's contributed to the middle hexagon. The less tiles you have, the more brown it will be. And the more tiles you have, the whiter it will be. It also differentiated the two ways that you can use four tiles. because there's one where it'll go white, brown, white, brown. And there's another one that'll go white, white, brown, brown. So that like user interface breakthrough was humongous for making the game actually playable for people.
That is so cool to see that. And did that breakthrough come before or after getting it signed?
I think it was after. I think it was well after. And actually, the player aid that we have for the game still shows both, because you kind of need to understand the thing about the tile to know how to build the little ring, but it just does show both. And then the nectar tiles that you find in the sort of on the main board also have that pattern on them. But the game, I probably worked on it for a year, maybe a year and a half before it was signed. I'm not, you know, this is in the distant past now. And then we developed it for, had to be 2 years. And they lived in Champaign, Illinois, and I lived in St. Louis, Missouri. And so we would like, you know, each drive an hour and a half and meet in Springfield, Illinois. It was probably like once a month or every 2 weeks or something. And it changed a lot. The core obviously stayed the same, but the worker placement changed a lot. And actually, like in the very, very late stages of the game, it took a big overhaul. And so what used to happen, one of my original conceptions of the game, it's sort of an engine building game in some sense, because as you build up your hive, you're sort of increasing your capacity. You can like make more honey to then sell. When you go to sell clover honey, you can sell as many clover honey as you have. So you can get more efficient sales if you can build up an engine that has a bunch of those things. So I wanted this choice between like, okay, am I going to expand my hive or am I going to use the hive that I have? That's sort of like a fundamental engine building question. Build the engine or use the engine? And so there were worker spaces where you would go and get action tiles to build your hive. And then the sort of like action bonus triggering was kind of like a bonus. It felt like not the core of the game, but it's just, if I did this thing, I got a bonus. That's good. But then there were all these other worker placement spots where I would go here to take a foraging action, or I would go here to take a sale action. So a much bigger worker placement board. And the problem was that the build your hive action was just way stronger because you needed to build your hive and it gave you these action bonuses. So for a long time, like almost for all of that time, we were trying to reconcile that. And the rule was just like, well, that space takes an extra worker. That was kind of the thing. It takes an extra worker. And we had that forever. And eventually we were like, the biggest, most important change probably in the whole development was take all of the other worker placement spaces away. And the only way to do things is to build your hive. And so it takes away that engine building choice because you are always extending your hive, but it's also still there because there are actions to get more workers, which is clearly an engine building choice, or to forage for more nectar. That's also an engine building choice. These are things that mostly don't get you points on their own. The way you get points is producing and selling honey. That to me now is one of the key hooks of the game, is that it's a worker placement game where you don't take actions, you take action tiles. And that didn't exist before. And it's the tile placement system is the same, but it also operates in a different way. Like the game is build your board in such a way to get the specific nectars, but also place to trigger combos in the sequences you need. So those late last minute tweaks can be like the revelation of your game. Now that I'm a developer, I am not constantly, but I find that this is a frequent challenge for designers, is the sort of anchor bias that they have to overcome. We talk about kill your babies, but it's like, you have to get back to staying open and just being like, what if it's different? And I think that maybe there's ways in which it's harder. You tell me if I'm wrong here, but I think it might be harder for the intuitive designer to go back to what if it's totally different. Do you think that's true?
You know, I'm not sure, because I'm trying to think of my games, how many of them kind of got rebooted. And I would say more than not, they tend to be fairly similar to what my original concept is. I don't know, my game Daughters of Asclepius, I've rebooted, including the mechanics. Like the only thing that stayed the same was like the theme and what I wanted to accomplish with it. But mechanic-wise, constantly kept changing. Now it has a co-designer, Roberta Taylor. And that one, it's like, it wouldn't have become the best form of itself, which is its current form, had I not rebooted and tried totally new things every single time. And so it was good for me to do it, but that's not normally my intuition is gut it all and try again with like new mechanics. Normally just let's tweak this one thing or let's add something. Actually, I cut more than I add things. Honestly, I'm all about streamlining.
For sure. And was it Roberta that really pushed you forward to like, hey, let's bring it back to square one or two? Or were you like, no?
Not even. It was me wanting to reboot it and me thinking this is the type of reboot I wanted, and knowing from getting to become closer friends with her that she might be the person I needed as like a sounding board and someone who does kind of the design space I wanted to do with the new mechanics I was going to try.
Yeah. I think what can be the hardest is when a designer feels like they've put a year into something and made it better and better and better so that they could get to the point of publishing it. And then when someone signs it, they feel like, yes, I did it. I made it a good enough thing. And then the developer goes like, okay, so now we're going to try to make it really like you thought it was good here, and we're going to try to take it really far forward. And maybe that means undoing the things that felt like definitely positive experience, positive direction for you. Like, maybe the things that you thought were the things that got it signed, like, we're going to undo those. And I think that can be really like earth shaking, maybe, for designers. They tried to make a thing. So as a developer, I just try to stay really collaborative so that we can feel like we're both making something we both like. That's so important because, I mean, in the Honeybuzz development, I was right there working all the time on it. I mean, Mike Hinson was the developer, but he and I did everything together, really. No choices were made kind of without me. If he had just done that on his own, I'm sure I would have freaked out. Because I can get territorial. I know that about myself. That I can like, and again, it goes back to like, wait, why? Tell me, explain it. And if you give me the reasons, I might be able to go like, okay, you're right. But if you just grab the hold and make the change, it's going to be really hard for me. But man, there's just so many things like that. And I, working on Trinket Trove, not to go into too many other side projects, but that is a game that I changed a lot in its development. And those things feel sometimes like different games, but sometimes you find something that's just, it just is better. And there's like a math analogy that I often make, which probably doesn't land for most people that don't study math. But like, if you have some function, okay, some graph, and you're trying to find the highest point. Actually, let's scrap that. If you're on some foreign landscape, you've landed on the planet Advantage, and you're trying to get to the highest point from where you are, you can like keep going a little bit higher. Look at the part that's next to you and go a little bit higher and a little bit higher every time. And maybe at some point you'll be like, hey, we reached the top. That doesn't mean there's not some mountain over there that's even higher. You know, and so sometimes the small little movements, they'll take you higher, but not as high as you could go. And you have to like jump over to a totally different part of the design space landscape to figure out what it might be like, you know?
Yeah, it's been an interesting time because I also do development, especially when I was working at Wise Wizard on the wacky side, especially occasionally on the Wise Wizard. But that going between taking a design that we've already signed, kind of gutting it, but keeping like the core values of the designer, but working with them to fix maybe some of the problems. It could be good or bad. Like, I've had headbutts with certain designers and others that were like, oh my God, this is so much better. And it's funny because I had one in particular that I had a lot of headbutting with, and it was at the beginning of my working for Wise Wizard. And I would constantly need to use, in the saddest way of saying, a man to step in. So like either a male coworker or even my boss would have to come in, say literally exactly what I already said. Designer would respect that. And then they would dip out and then we continue. And later on when the game was published, they realized like, oh, we're reprinting this. The game is better because of what I had done for it. And it's funny because like at the time, had we kept it the way they wanted it, it wouldn't have been as successful. If, I mean, maybe wouldn't have been successful.
Yeah. I have had a couple of designer diaries have been published for the games that I worked on recently as developer. And both of them said basically this story of like, Paul was doing these things and I was like, oh no, what is this? But he was right. And I feel like that as a developer is so gratifying. Because obviously we would expect that these things would be hard for the developers who have had so much of their hands on the game up to that point. But then to ultimately feel like, ah, yes, I do add value. Like I do have some nudge in the positive direction. That feels really good. There's so many board game podcasts. There's so many design podcasts. There's probably no game development podcasts. And I think that's a really interesting piece. Maybe it's a little too niche, like people like you and me and people that work in this hobby are interested in it. But it's so different, I think, from designing in a way that I didn't understand previously.
Yeah, I've touched on it quite a few times in various episodes. One in particular with Julia Ahern. She talks about how she started as a developer and became a co-designer, which I feel is kind of a hard line sometimes where I feel like I've done so much work that I should be a co-designer, but that's not our job. Like, we are a developer, even if we've completely rechanged everything and it's not really the designer's initial game anymore. We technically signed it on behalf of them in their contract. They are the ones that get their name on the box. And it's one of those things where unless the designer specifically says, hey, I think the developer has done all this work, I'd really like them to have co-design credit or have their name on the box, I don't think it's a developer's place to put their name, even if internally you might feel like you should have the same level of credit. That's always kind of a hard struggle.
Let me nudge into this direction. I know we're here to talk about Honeybuzz, but this is the stuff I want to talk about. So I have a game coming out with 25th Century called Lobby Snacks. It's a trick-taking game, basically. And Taylor Reiner of Taylor's Trick-Taking Table and Sears Catalog and stuff, he was the developer. And he and I worked on it a lot. And me, being a designer and a developer, recognized like exactly how much value he added. And so I basically asked him if he would want to be on the cover. But the idea was I would be always credited as the designer and he would always be credited as the developer. But on the cover, it would say Paul Solomon, top line, next line, with Taylor Reiner. In my mind, that has become the solution to the thing we're talking about. Is like, if there's a game that I've worked on that I feel like I added enough to want that credit, and also it has to be a game that like I'm really proud of and would want to associate my design like vision with, you know what I mean? Then I will sometimes say like, hey, you know, and please, you can absolutely say no to this, but are you comfortable with it saying like Rocco Privatero with Paul Solomon? And in the case of Trinket Trove, he said yes. And in the case of Corgi Pileup, I said I wanted to be co-designer, but that was really, really, really early on because I could see like there's a core of the Good Atama card game and we're really going to change that a lot. So if we're going to do this, I want to be co-designer. And I feel like that's a model that can work, but it is still an awkward conversation. Yeah, I wish we had a little closer to a industry standard on that. One thing I will say about development though is I will no longer develop anything unless I get a royalty. Does not have to be much. You know, 1-2% I think developers deserve. That's kind of where I'm at. I didn't get a royalty on Santa's Workshop and I regret that. But everything I do at Gamehead, I get a royalty on. And if I ever work for somebody else, I insist on the same.
That's so interesting because I feel like for me, development was always part of my paycheck. So I was getting paid a steady income salary, but I have gotten like percentages as a developer when I'm just putting in man hours, or what do we call it, man hours, work hours. So that's always a fascinating one. And your comment of putting the with Paul Solomon on the box for the developer, I actually have that in a contract that by the time this airs will have been signed. And it was a situation where me and my friend were going to do a first play test of a game I had thought up. And we just happened to have another friend join that first initial play test who was also a publisher. And she immediately was like, can I sign this game? And I was like, what? Like, first playtest. And it was weird because it was a conversation with my friend and I, because we were going to come up with a bunch of concepts together, but my grandma had passed away. And so like, I ended up designing some, he designed some separately. We played two of those concepts and mine got an offer immediately. So it became this really awkwardness of I'm the designer, but he was also like, our intention was to work together. And so what our solution was, we signed the contract as me designer with a higher percent royalty, him as developer with a smaller percent. But because the publisher is also so actively developing at this point, most of it is pretty similar to the initial design, but enough of it where I asked in the contract that both of their names be on the box as like developers, whether that be with or developed by, but I wanted them to have that credit on the
right
box.
Or you can have the icons, right?
Yeah, exactly. But for me, that felt like a good solution.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, again, you and I have been on both sides, so we know like there is a sort of muddy place between design and development. What happened with a couple games is they were signed before I showed up to Gamehead. And so it was like, well, normally I would just say, this game's not in a place where I would want to publish it. You know, it's not close enough or whatever. Because if it's close, then you know you're just doing minor tweaks and this and that. But I had games on my hand where I was like, I know I'm going to have to do major overhaul design work. And if you're doing that, it feels more like when you look at the final product, you go like, I know how much of this is me. You know, that can happen when you look at the final game and you go, I'm all over this thing except for the box. And that cannot feel good sometimes.
Yeah, it is. It's a weird space to live in. And definitely open communication is the path forward for that kind of thing. And I used to say when I first started designing that I wanted my kids out of the basement and I want like nothing to do with them. Like I want them out in the world. And then in actuality, when I started signing games and doing it as a full-time gig, like I loved being a part of every process. Like I loved reviewing art or giving graphic notes or trying to come up with like the UX on it. There were just so many pieces to it that I enjoyed to the point where it became part of my full-time job, using those skills that I enjoyed so much and kind of cultivated through various past experiences.
Yeah. And I am very much the same way of like, I want all the creators in the room at the same time, everybody giving their ideas. And like when we get a cover image, I want the graphic designer and the artist and the designer and me to give feedback on it. The only thing that I think is especially important there is that we all have to know where the final decision comes. And it's like, if we're not getting that, if that's where it's going to fall apart, that's where it's going to fall apart. So when I sign a game, I always say to designers, like, this has happened to me every time I've ever signed a game. There will come a moment where, as a designer, I am telling the developer or the publisher, this thing must go this way. These numbers have to be this. The art has to look like this. The graphic design has to be this. And I will lose. Because that's how it's going to happen. And so I tell the designers, this is going to happen to you, where you're going to have really strong feelings about what the game should be, but you won't have the power to make it happen. And so if the more you can prepare yourself for that to happen once or twice, the easier it will be to be in the room and be validated and valued for every other discussion we have. I think that's like an important lesson.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of guests I have on here come to that realization or something similar, and they actually decide to self-publish because they want full control. And I honestly get it. I have been lucky to have as much control as I have over my games. Most designers do not get the level in which I do, which is good and bad, because like a lot of times I'm doing free work for my games. But in my mind, the better the game turns out, the more likely it is to reprint. So down the line, I actually do make more money. So put your luck game.
That's what Joe Wiggins says too, is like, trust me, no one wants to sell your game more than I do. So put some faith in me. The other like one interesting story I have about this sort of designer developer headbutt is I published Stamp Swap with Stonemaier Games, and Jamie was the developer, and he and I did that all very quickly, and he has his own styles, which were different but cool and great. But when it got to the Automa Factory, who does the solo mode, Morton, who's the sort of, I guess, the leader of Automa Factory, had some really specific balance notes and a ton of data, very data-driven on the solo side, which normally would really work with me. But there was something about it that was making me nervous. And there were some emails going back and forth about, I don't know, hand-wringing. And the way that Jamie resolved it, I thought was really interesting, because all he did was set up an email or set up a meeting, video chat, to, you know, figure it out. And in the meeting, he didn't talk really almost at all. He barely even looked at the video, which I thought was amazing. He was there. He was like doing
babysitter
email or something. Yeah. I mean, like, he was so inactive, but he was there and we said things, and by the end, it was like resolved. So I don't know if that's common for him or like, but it was so interesting to just sort of like, I guess, hold some authority over the space without having to really engage at all. He didn't have to mediate. He didn't, you know, have to like, okay, Paul, what I'm hearing you say is this, you know what I mean? And I guess there was a lesson for me in there as a teacher too, about like, managing the people in the room and the energies. So that the development work is just so different in a, it is so much more collaborative in a different way than the design, which can feel very siloed off and I'm in charge. And we have play tests sometimes where you play someone's game and you go, here's some stuff. And all they do is tell you why you're wrong.
Which isn't good as a designer. You should write everything down.
I wouldn't say so.
Yeah, and make it a conversation. Because sometimes you might say they're wrong this time, but if that same feedback keeps coming back, you probably need to change something.
Yeah, and that's what I was saying earlier is like, you might know numerically they're wrong, but if people keep saying it, it matters just as much as anything.
Totally. And how did you end up getting Honeybuzz placed with Elf Creek, by the way? I don't think we mentioned that.
Yeah. So I sort of touched on it really fast earlier, but I went to this meetup and I had the one person who had done a Kickstarter game. I said, you know, whatever. He said, talk to my friend John from Genius Games. And I ended up publishing a couple games with John. And he was my neighbor for a while. But then John introduced me to Jamie. And I pitched the game to Jamie. That's how he and I met. He basically gave me some notes and suggested I whatever. So then I reworked it and then showed him again at Geekway a little later. And he, you know, officially passed at that point. Oh, at Geekway, I had like a, there was a designer row, prototype row. So I was set up there and Gray Fox Games came by. As you can tell, there's like a hub of publishers in St. Louis, like a ton of them. And it's amazing. And Miniature Market. And he, Gray Fox took it for a while and they had it play tested a bunch and they gave it back to me because they said the play testing data is really good. All the numbers are really high, but we think it's because people might know you. And I said, okay, that's fine. So I got it back. And then I took it to Stonemaier Games Design Day in St. Louis. And like just got a, the night before Jamie said like, oh, we have a spot. Do you want to set up? So I set up Honeybuzz and I think it might've been like, I don't remember now. It might have been the highest rated or the second highest rated on the day or something. And my friend Miles played it and he told the Elf Creek guys, like, you should definitely take a look at this. And so that's how it ended up working. We played it somewhere and, you know, eventually I was down in my basement right here where I am now having meetings about, you know, contract details and stuff. And then those guys made a really good game out of it. Really, really good product that sits on shelves.
Mm-hmm. And what was your favorite and least favorite part of that design journey?
Let's see. My favorite part of that design journey, I do remember, I do have a funny story from it, which is, I like to tell this. It's not my favorite. It could be my favorite. It could be my least favorite. But the first time that I ever put this game on a table, it was paper and it had ideas in it that, I mean, it was so far away from what it came to be. And I sat down at the table with my friend Royce, who was that one guy who had had a game on Kickstarter and a very interesting character. But we played the game and I said, so like, yeah, what do you think? What's your feedback? And he said, you know, I think if I bought that game and I brought it home and played it, I'd probably just throw it away. That's what he said, something like that. And he wasn't being mean. He wasn't even angry, but like he was just communicating that in this simple way that for me, it was like, oh, okay. All right. Interesting. I don't know. I just think that's funny, but I would never give someone feedback like that, but I thought it's funny. I do remember the good feeling of like being at that prototype row and having somebody come by a publisher and then go, I'm going to go get my boss and come back and having them say it's good. Some of the coolest stuff though has been Geekway to the West, which is my favorite, you know, it's my home convention in St. Louis. It's one of my favorites to go to. Just seeing people play it on tables, just having it like in the play and win lobby, I mean, library and have it on tables. That's really satisfying. The most painful point for me, well, I haven't received royalties in a good long while. That's pretty painful. But we're starting to see some improvements there. But there was, you know, one of these fights, I was really, really hung up on like, we have to have these three little trophy components. And for some reason, the publisher was like, absolutely not. And it didn't make any sense to me. So in terms of actual raw feelings, that felt really bad in that moment. But outside of that, it's been all very, you know, design. We get to play around. We get to make things on tables that look the way we want. And it's been really, really lovely, especially with Honeybuzz.
That's great. And do you have a really big like takeaway from your experience? I mean, I know Elf Creek has had some very awkward history moments. And so I don't know if you learned something from that experience or just from developing with them, if you have just like one piece of almost advice or takeaway.
From being head of development, I mean, I learned 1,000 things about how to run a business better. So I've brought that to Gamehead, and everything that I needed to know to do my creative director job at Gamehead, I learned at Elf Creek. So I'm really, really, really grateful for that. You know, I think there's 100 little lessons in here. One of the big ones is about the art. I think that really matters. And, you know, I every game's got its own little intricacies about what make them work and don't. But to have a really clearly definable, I don't want to say pitch, I don't want to say elevator pitch, but like core concept of what your game is. And when we did development, it refined down to where I could give that clear, succinct elevator pitch about what it is thematically, about bees discovering economics, but also mechanically. This is a worker placement game where you get action tiles, and the action tiles combine in different ways to trigger action combos. That tells you what the game is and what's unique about it. And when I field the 300 pitches a year I field from designers, the thing that they need to be able to tell me is what the game is. As a developer too, it's like when I sign your game or someone hands me your signed game, I need to know what your core concept is. And if your core concept is like princesses riding turtles, that's something, but it isn't a game design. I need a bit more to stay on top of, because I want to live with your core vision and core concept and make a product that works, but you need to at least know what that core concept is. So when I'm doing dev and design, and we're trying, like you said, to streamline down and crystallize this most pure, like proper, excellent final version of the game, we have to have some sense of what it's going towards.
No, I completely agree. And I know you've touched on quite a few projects, but is there any projects that people should be looking out for in the future from you?
Oh, yeah. So Gamehead, I work very fast on a lot of games. We have a Reiner Knizia game, Wild Magic, coming out this year, which has got awesome Jackie Davis art. We have a really incredible Taiki Shinzawa trick-taking game called Trick to the Future. Basically, the cards have like digital clock numbers on them in the middle. And you have these fuel rods, which are Catan Road sticks. And when you play a card, you can put sticks on it to change the number. And there's more to it. But that hook is really cool. And the art is insane, I will say as well. And we have an amazing party game, which I think you've played, from our friend Scott Brady, called Sizewise. So this one has a string, which has a ring on one side and a sliding bead. And so you flip a card that says something like, what is the size of a drumstick? And then everyone slides the bead until they get to what they think is the size of a drumstick. And people go like, well, what do you mean size? Like the length or the width or the height? And it's like, well, it doesn't say. And then everyone hangs these next to each other, and the shortest and the longest take a strike, a penalty point. So you don't want to be this. You don't want to be the outliers. You want to be kind of right in the middle, the Goldilocks, as I like to say. And sometimes it's like, oh, wait, oh, you meant the drumstick like the chicken? Because I was thinking drumstick like the drumstick. Like, and then I tried to pipe in a lot of things like, what's the size of a unicorn's horn? Because people always want to, it's funny when you play this with gamers, they go like, well, where does it say what the right answer is? And it's like, no, you're missing it. They're like, and I get this feedback over and over. You should like put the numbers on there so that people can see whether they were right or wrong. And it's like, no, the game's about whether you're matching the other people in the room. It's more social than that. But this game is crazy fun and toyetic, and I'm so excited for that one to come out. And of course, many, many more. But check out gamehead.com. Follow on Instagram at gameheadgames to see everything that's coming out.
Sweet. And then for my last question, if you could have been the designer of any game that you didn't design, which would you choose?
Gosh, it's an awesome question. This is like the biggest, not really a compliment, but when I think about the biggest compliment I can pay to a game, it's just like when I go, God, I wish I had designed that. There's so many that come to mind. Coloretto is like an immediate one because it's so good. I would say I have to pick a Phil Walker Harding game just because he's my design icon. And I wish that I had designed Imhotep. It is so clean and good and interactive and engaging ways and simple and just like variable. You know, they have, I don't even know, they have 4 to the 5 different combinations. That's a very big number. So it's like 1,000 different games you can play. That's just, it's one I'll never get rid of. I'll always keep it.
That's awesome. I love Phil. He was actually my 100th episode because also same big icon. And, you know, I've met him now a few times in person and we get along really well. So it's great to see good people making great games.
Yeah. He pitched me a couple designs one time and I didn't get to sign him when I was at Elf Creek, but I keep emailing him. Hey, send me another one. Send me another one.
Amazing. Well, and everyone who's been listening, thanks for joining for this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 133, Honey Buzz. And Paul, thanks for joining. And you've already plugged Gamehead's info. Do you have any personal info you want people to know to find you online?
I am PaulSolomon27 on Instagram, and that's where you can see anything I'm doing, but it's a lot of Gamehead.
Perfect. And then I've been your host, I'm Danielle Reynolds. And if you're trying to find my personal social media, I am as Token Gamer, spelled J-Y-M-E-R, and that's on mostly Instagram. And then I also have started some fun short form videos for Game Design Unboxed. That's going to be on Instagram and TikTok. So definitely check those out. And Paul, thanks again for being on. This was awesome. Way to kick off the 7th season.
Thank you. Loved it.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out NoDirectionPodcasts.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out AllPlay at Let'sAllPlay.com. Join us next time.